You're listening to Trot the Egging, hosted by John Hetherington, working with Widnes Rugby Union Football Club, sponsored by Boydells. Follow, like, share, subscribe and endorse us via Facebook, Trot the Egging, Twitter, @TrotTheEgging/@JohnHeth, Instagram, @Trot_D_Egg_In, YouTube, Trot the Egging, LinkedIn, John Hetherington, and Spotify, Trot the Egging. This week's rugby story is that of a really popular player who played in tough environments, led his teams around the pitch seamlessly, which led to lots of silverware, both collectively and individually. That was no accident. His career includes spells at Hindley, Oldham, Bradford Bulls, Wigan Warriors. He also played for Lancashire, England and Great Britain. He coached with Wigan Warriors, England Rugby League and currently Sale Sharks. Ladies and gents, it's the legend Mr. Paul Deacon.
No worry. So how are you and the family doing, Deeks?
All good, thanks, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't complain.
Good man. So before we get stuck into your rugby story, where was home for a young Paul Deacon and who lived with you, mate?
Rugby.
So where was you brought up as a kid?
Sorry, cut tight with the wire. In Wigan. Been in Wigan all my life. Just the centre of Wigan, really.
Right.
By my parents, only child, no pets. So, yeah, a lonely childhood. No, I'm only joking. Can't compare a good childhood, yeah. Yeah. A normal childhood, really.
Yeah. So, man, so how did become introduced? Obviously, with Wigan being... Your whole hand is not about that and football, isn't it? But
yeah, rugby. Well, I played every sport as a kid. I have good conversations now with the lads I coach now about how it was different in our day growing up. Like, there was only three channels on the telly, wasn't there? And whatever sport was on three channels. So every time sport was on the telly, it was like exciting. I remember I used to run home from field to watch the World Snooker Championship and things like that, you know, when it was on. So that sort of kid, that's what I was. I was, whatever was on telly, I wanted to play. Whatever I was watching, right. I wanted to play. So snooker, when Wimbledon came on, I went down the tennis courts with my dad. Football, rugby, yeah, whatever I could watch, I wanted to practice and get into.
When did you get took down to a rugby club, was it? And do you reckon you was when you first went?
I went when I just turned about 9, so I was 9 years of age, and one of my mates, so he used to play out with on the streets back in them days. His dad said, "Oh, spoke to my dad, said, do you think he'd fancy a game of rugby?" So my dad took me down, and for some reason, I still don't know why, he was at Hindley. Which is now Hindley Juniors. I think it was Hindley Giants back then. So I just went down there and loved it straight from the start, yeah.
Right, and you was in the army. I know at that age, it's just a bit of cardine and that, but did you always have that ability to semi-organise even as a young kid?
Well, I suppose I did, but I didn't know. Yeah. I didn't know it at the time. I suppose I was a bit of a... could say a bit of a bossy boots with my mates back when I was a kid. You know, I always wanted to play my game what we should be doing. But I was very lucky. I was very lucky that I had a great coach from under 9s all the way till under 16s, really.
And a guy. Did he stay with you, Paul? Yeah.
Yeah, he stayed with us till, probably 15s, under 15, 16s. He left us and a guy called Cliff Peters. And he sort of gave me that role early on. And I always remember that our team, with him coaching us, we seemed to be a step above every other team. So, like under 9s, we had a first receiver or players off 9.
Yeah.
When the other teams were just getting a first receiver, we had a second receiver. Right. It's part of my job to call the plays. So, he helps in that massively.
Yeah. Right, mate. So, was there any like town team stuff when you were in like year 6? So, what's that, 10, 11? Get involved in that?
Town team started at under 11s. So I actually went for the trials a year young and just missed out. It's one of my claims to fame, really. One of my mates wore my shin pads at Wembley because back then it was the under-11s town teams that used to play in the curtain raiser before the Challenge Cup.
All right, okay.
So, yeah, missed out there, but then got in when it was my year.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, played in under-11s, under-13s. It was an under-15s and then under-16s town team, yeah, there at Wigan.
How did you take the initial rejection back, mate? Because it obviously we'll touch on it later on, but your career's been very prolific. So you don't often hear of, other than a couple of injuries that you had, you never really had, from what I can remember.
Yeah, I was fortunate in my career, yeah.
Yeah.
I had some disappointments. You know, I had quite a few right at the end of my season, my career, actually.
Right, yeah.
We might get into, like you say, but... yeah, I wasn't too disheartened because obviously I was a year younger back then. So
yeah,
in that respect, I didn't really get any real setbacks until I was around 16 when sort of all my mates who played in the town team were getting signed up and I wasn't. So
fair enough, mate. And the rugby helped you with the transition into high school, and how did you end that and where did you go?
High school went to Standish High, which is just up the road from where I live, really.
Yeah.
Not many of my mates were going there. They were going to the deanery. Just a small few of us who travelled up to Standish from our primary school. So, all new world, meeting new mates and that.
Yeah, and what's the standard of school rugby like compared to your club rugby?
Nowhere near. I was very fortunate. Again, I spoke about the coach that took us at Hindley.
Yeah.
In my age group, the two best teams in the country were from Wigan.
Right.
And it just drops on certain years like that, aren't they? So
yeah.
It was us and Oral St. James that were going hammer and tong with each other all through my career, really. And we sort of were getting on top up until about under 12s, 13s. And then they had a lot of lads that grew a little bit before I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, they started running over us, but probably one of my best victories they ever had was in the under-16s North West Counties Cup, where we beat Oral for the first time in about 4 years. So,
right, mate. So, any rugby union cross your path early on?
Not at all, no. None. Wasn't interested in it. You know, I look back now and you sort of get brainwashed. So, rugby union, it's rubbish.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
Those 80,000 people watching England, you know, every Six Nations at Twickenham. So, if I'm honest, I grew up not liking rugby union because I was sort of, in hindsight, I was jealous of it. But that's the way it was in Wigan and St Helens.
Yeah. You know, yeah, Witness was the same. Yeah, yeah. I grew up playing rugby league and rugby union weren't an option, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, when did you begin to get looked at and noticed, maybe? Was you aware of scouts or out par?
I was never aware of them at games, if I'm honest, no. Yeah. It wasn't really in my psyche that I was going to be a professional rugby league player.
Yeah.
And, you know, around 16, I got in the England Schoolboys, which was a massive honour at the time. And
yeah.
And like I said earlier, all my sort of mates who I was playing with were getting signed up by Wigan, St Helens, Warrington.
Yeah.
You know, the three sort of big teams at that time, a few by Witness as well. And I thought, you know, it's different than it is now. Now we've got scholarships, but there it was just sort of like you got signed up and started playing.
Yeah, like a YTS, wasn't it?
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
So, none of them were interested in me. So I was quite lucky. I ended up going to Oldham Burghs.
Yeah.
Signing for Oldham Burghs. My North West County schoolboy coach was assistant coach there, a guy called Dennis McHugh. He was coaching at Oldham at the time, and he snapped me up to go up to Oldham. So, yeah, that was a great experience for me. It was daunting at the time because I didn't know anyone. I was quite a shy kid, if I'm honest. Hey there, John. Just lost you.
Yeah, I mean, mate, yeah. So yeah. You touched on Mr. McKee, your mate, and snapping you up.
Yeah, so he signed me for Oldham Burghs, which was quite daunting.
Yeah.
Didn't know anyone there. And, you know, I'd played in good teams. You know, I think you know, the Wigan Town team that I played, it was, you know, I don't think we lost a game in 11, yeah. 13, 16, or not one I can remember. So, yeah, going up to Oldham was a great experience for me when in hindsight, looking back, it taught me a lot.
Yeah, so if we just go back a little bit, maybe, so what sort of steps did you have to go through for England school boys? So you'd have started at Wigan, wouldn't you? And,
yeah, so basically, yeah. That was sort of picked through the town team. So,
right.
Yeah, obviously, I was in the Wigan under-16s town team and then got selected for Lancashire. So you played Lancashire v Yorkshire. And then that was sort of the trial match, really, for the England school board.
Yeah. Right, so what's it like when you rock up at Oldham and you're still a young kid, really, aren't you? In like a men's world now, if that's the right thing to say, but...
No, it was definitely the right thing to say. I mean, you know, I look at kids coming through now, it's probably even more of a men's world than it is now, you know. It was daunting. It was... it was massive for me, really, in my rugby career. I always say to people that if I'd have got signed by Wigan or a Warrington or a St Helens or Widnes, I don't think I'd have made it. I really don't think I would have.
Right.
Going to Oldham was, you know, I had to roll my sleeves up and do a bit of extra work because I played with all the best players in my career, and that was no longer the case up at Oldham. So, I had to sort of prove myself. You know, I learnt a lot there. I ended up fortunately getting into the A team after about half a season in the academy, playing against men when I was, you know, just turned 17, I think. So, you sort of thrown into the lion's den and see how you cope with it.
Yeah, how do you adjust to them environments, mate? You said, so you've been, in your world, playing with some of the best players in the country, haven't you? To having to basically tell seasoned men's rugby players what you want them to do for you.
Yeah, well, this is why it was such a great experience for me, because it was hard, but I'll never forget one of my first training sessions. It was on this, if you can call it a field, like the facilities were terrible up there and it was freezing cold, you know, pre-season. And I always remember the coach saying, I overheard him saying, I thought we signed this lad because he could organise. That's what I thought. He didn't know about me, you know.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, because I was a shy lad and I didn't want to, you know, put myself forward straight away. I was quite shy.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, well, I'll show you.
Yeah.
And then I sort of took over and, you know, did what I did as all through my junior career. So, I think looking back, I didn't want to be embarrassed. You know, I didn't want to let anyone down. And I knew deep down that was my job in the rugby field. You know, if I didn't do that, I had no chance. So, it was a massive learning curve for me, but really good. Really good looking back. Yeah. Invaluable.
So that at Mold, mate, is an organiser. You're like a quarterback, basically. Is that, and a leader, mate? And it's something you have for your career, and we'll touch on more. But is it a role you think you're already had in yet, or is it something you think you developed in, especially during that spoiled them, obviously helped that?
Yeah, obviously that helped the development. I think, you know, having the coach I did as a kid growing up, but I think I suppose it was in me. It was in me to boss people about. What are like, I don't know, tech charges situations. You know, and I did grasp that, like I said, from my coach when I was 9 years old. They gave me the job and, you know, I took it on board and took pride in it, you know, and wanted to be the best at it.
Yeah. So going to Oldham, mate, no one really probing you about pinching you before you went there, no?
Not to Oldham, no. That was, I was just at college at the time doing my A-levels. And
right.
Going to Oldham because I like playing rugby and a bit of pocket rugby. Yeah. I remember back in the day, when I got to the A team after about half a season, you used to get 60 quid a win. It was brilliant, you know.
Big money, mate, yeah.
Well, massive when you know, you could have a nice
day.
You know, so, yeah, were good times, really good times, yeah.
How was that step up from academy to A League?
Massive.
Was
like, it? You know, you're playing with lads your own age and then you're going playing against men. And back then, it was a tough league. It was, you know, all the fellas that were in that league wanted to get to the first team. You know, so again, it was daunting, but a massive learning curve for me, which, you know, I'm so glad I went through.
Yeah. So how did you go before we talk about the big move most people will remember you for, mate? What that moment do you remember from the olden days, barring that class pitch you trained on?
Yeah. I remember it being cold. I remember it being hilly. The pre-season were pretty hard because there was a lot of hills in I remember us having a really, really good A team, you know, and I really enjoyed my time playing in that team. You know, some good players and good coaches, and it was just a good club. You felt like appreciated. You felt looked after there, and even though the facilities were under par, I'd say it was just a real, really massive experience. And you know, I grew a lot in them couple of years. I think I played two seasons up there.
It's like real rugby, mate, isn't it? Like you said, the facilities and that, and knuckle down and get on, isn't it? And
yeah, I suppose you could describe it as properly old school, you know.
Yeah. So when that move does come around to Bradford, mate, was that brought to you? And what else options? But I imagine there was a queue of people for you, really.
No, mate. No.
No.
Came out of the blue. I got a phone call one day from Matthew Elliott, and I answered, and this Aussie was on the phone, and I thought, this can't be right. This is not right, you know. I was just all about my business. I'd just finished my A levels and signed up to go to university. And you know, Bradford, that was at the end of 97 season. They'd just won the Super League.
Yeah.
I was a fan watching them on the telly. And Matt gave me a call and said, would you fancy it? I couldn't believe it, really. And I think it came from a semi-final, the A-team semi-final, where I played Bradford for Oldham, and I think we beat them. I believe Brian Noble was at the game, so he sort of saw me play. And that's where that opportunity came from.
When you're going up to meet these characters, mate, because you're talking international rugby, but there's no art yet. Is it daunting sitting down and having serious meetings with these people, are you? Because you seem pretty laid back, so have you just took...
Yeah, we're very daunting. Like I said, I'm quite chill, but I'm quite shy as well. Naturally, I always have been. So, yeah, when I'm talking to Matthew Elliott on the phone, I'm thinking, geez, he's just won the Super League. Like, what's he phoning me for? But it was daunting. But that sort of process of signing for him was quite straightforward. Other than I wanted to keep doing my university course. So, back then, I signed at Oldham as at Bradford, as an academy player. I played the first half of the season for the academy and trained with the first team on my couple of days off that I got from university. So, and then an interesting story, but not many people remember. One of my boyhood heroes, Sean Edwards, signed for Bradford at the same time.
All right, okay.
But he left it half the season in.
Yeah.
I was sort of playing for the academy, and when Sean left halfway through the season, Matthew Elliott brought me into his office and said, we want you to play scrum half for the rest of the year, but you'll have to come full time. That's where my sort of contract changed, and at university, and thought I'd give it a shot. So yeah, got the opportunity really by somebody else leaving the club, and yeah, the rest was history really, I suppose.
You know, and sometimes, Paul, that's how it happens, isn't it? You've got to grasp a chance when it comes, and like you said, that was your chance, mate.
Oh, massively. I always say, you get given an opportunity, you got to take it. I think I did. But that's the thing, like, some lads don't get them opportunities, you know?
No.
Till the end of the season, and then I wouldn't have got my shot. I mean, you know, after the next season, they signed Henry Paul. So, if Sean had stayed that season, I may never have got the opportunity, and who knows where I'd be, you know?
Yeah. And what's it like? So imagine you'd have been picking his brain, your train, watching how he does. Because the game's very different, mate, isn't it? But people understand what you do. the Monday to Friday if you sat the game or whatever. So how's that in the week when you're rubbing shoulders with all these types of people?
Yeah, it was amazing, really. Like I said, yeah. Champions, you know. And then obviously they signed Sean as well, who I watched as a kid all through my childhood. So, you know, learning off them. The biggest thing I learned was how to conduct yourself, how to work hard, you know, and how to earn respect, really, from your peers, you know, because, again, you know, I was lucky being signed for Oldham, which at the time I didn't feel lucky, you know, because all my mates had gone to the bigger club. But I you know, got to Bradford at the right time. They were at the peak, you know, there was some real, real tough professionals there, which I just sat and listened to them, you know, in the bar after games, you know, listening to them in the changing rooms. I just used to soak it all up. And was in awe of them, really, for a long time.
That's it. How can't you be in it? When, especially you're achieving with them as well. Eventually, so, do you know when these, like you've just mentioned a few names, Sean Edwards and Henry, how does that make you feel? If they sign it when you're auditioning, do you see it as, I don't like it, but, or do you see it as an opportunity to get better?
Sorry, John, I missed that question. It just went a bit...
Sorry, mate. So when you're a young lad and you're in that type of environment and they're signing the characters you talk about, which are big, mate. You signed for a reason yourself, but do you get as a thought this is something you can learn from and keep yourself better?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. You learn from the best, don't you? You learn from watching and observing. And it was frustrating. You know, I had a great first season, I thought. Second half of the season where I got the chance.
Yeah.
Started every game, and then Henry Paul comes along, one of the world's best players. And, you know, I'm out the team for a lot of the time. But I suppose I have to thank Matthew Elliott massively that he had a lot of faith in me. And I wasn't never really out the match day squad. I was, you know, I spent most of the time for the next couple of years on the bench.
Yeah.
You know, he did start me in a few games and he looked after me that way as well. So I suppose looking back, that, you know, that was really good as well, you know, getting a taste of it week in, week out, playing with all these great players and, you know, still being involved when, you know, I could have easily put somebody else on the bench. So,
yeah. So before we touch on some of your big, best memories, was there anyone that have gone during your Bradford days and turned your head sort of there? Because you're sort of on top of the world and you seem like at times you were unplayable, weren't you? And did you ever fancy a new challenge, or was that exactly what you had to be doing in the trophies, playing with the big names all the time?
Yeah, I was very happy at Bradford. I mean,
yeah,
probably the time of my life, you know, that period, early 2000s.
Yeah.
You know, we went to 5 straight Super League finals and, you know, Henry left at the end of 2001 and, you know, that was my sort of chance to cement my place in the team, which I ended up doing. So, never really thought of leaving, if I'm honest.
You
know, because it was such a good time. There was once actually when Brian Noble took over the club and Matthew Elliott went back to Canberra.
Yeah.
Matt gave me a call and see if I'd fancy, you know, going over there to Canberra. And I think I was 21, 22 at the time. And, you know, I just didn't fit at the right time. And Henry Paul was leaving as well. So I thought, right,
yeah,
chance to really cement my place. So turn that opportunity down. And, you know, who knows if I'd have gone to camera, what would have happened. But, you know, I can't say I regret it with what happened.
Yeah, I can't imagine you do, mate. Yeah. So when Derby's are playing, the Bradford Leeds Derby's for a starter, and is the build-up to that game?
Oh, yeah, massive games. You know,
yeah.
Back then, you know, I'm a Wigan fan through and through, and the Wigan Saints Derby's was the biggest. You know, you brought up with that, but you know, when you placed over in Bradford and Leeds at the time, the two, you know, two great teams, it was just as big, you know. Yeah. And I suppose it's very hard to compare derbies. I mean, if you live in Hull, the Hull's the biggest derby.
Biggest, yeah.
Back then, Bradford Leeds were the biggest derby. Saints and Wigan and say that's the biggest derby. So, you know, they're all big because they mean so much to the fans, really.
Yeah. And when you, you know, the cup finals and that you're playing, mate, and I understand a lot of the hard work is done well into them positions. It's just about your execution, your timings, and obviously your pick, everyone wants it, don't they? But how hard is it to get there? How's the leading up into your cup finals and your grand finals? And what are you playing it? Your Wembley's, your Old Trafford's, you play Millennium, didn't you?
Yeah, Millennium, yeah.
Yeah. So what are them big arenas like, mate?
Oh, amazing. Amazing. I'll never forget the first time I walked out at Old Trafford. Like,
yeah.
You know, walked out years on the back of your neck stand up. You feel a shiver all the way through. I mean, the noise is unbelievable at Old Trafford because, you know, and most of them stadiums, you know, Cardiff, we played under the roof in 2003. Yeah. Challenge Cup final, that was absolutely amazing. You know, I'll never forget going in the stadium the day before. You know, we had a walk around the stadium the day before and I was practicing my kicking and I just thought, this is the biggest PE hall in the world, you know. It was,
yeah.
It was weird. It was so bizarre that, you know, you got the roof over you in such an enormous stadium. But yeah, walking out for finals was special. But it was also nerve-wracking. You know, the emotions that you go through, especially in the early days when that's why you play the game, innit? I used to kick a ball on the local rugby field, you know, imagining kicking the winning goal in the Challenge Cup final. And you know, the minute you're there doing it, it's like, it's exciting, but it's also very nerve-wracking. And, you know, you don't want to let anyone down. You don't want to let your teammates down or the fans. And I'll never forget, it's very hard to explain, but first 10 minutes of a final, you feel so unfit. And I think it's all the emotional energy that's burnt up during the week and the build-up to it. And, you know, such a big occasion. So, you know, I can understand that when you see players sort of like in finals and you think the nerves and, you know, the sort of anticipation of it all through the week just, you get out there, it takes you a while to get your second wind.
Yeah, I can imagine, mate. I can imagine. So what settles that, mate? Like an early touch, or would you have like that? Ideally, an early score settles anyone, but
yeah, things like that do help. 100%.
Yeah.
I think the older, more experience you get, the more finals you're playing, you sort of like the emotions aren't the same in the build-up, so you learn how to control them. You know, and you learn how to, you know, when you are getting a bit carried away, you can't sleep at night, just to switch off and say, you know, it's just another game.
Yeah.
So, you know, that helps, experience helps. But yeah, when you're in it, you just have to get through it. You just have to keep going. You sort of get the wind after about 10 or 15 minutes where the feeling in your legs come back.
So when did it come a point in your career when you maybe got went on to share that with people that had been in your shoes? If that makes sense. So when did you begin to be that influence on people where it's like, listen, we've earned the right to be here. Don't do nothing we haven't done. When do you get to impose that? Or when you're ready to?
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to impose that on someone. You know, you have chats with your teammates or, you know, share experience in team meetings every now and again. But that sort of stuff doesn't happen loads. You know, you can tell somebody, but until they've gone through it, it's very hard for them to understand.
Right.
But yeah, and, you know, like I said before, that sort of period from 99 to 2005, I was fortunate to play in a lot of finals. And it's probably only when you start not playing in them that you look back and think, Jesus, you missed them. You know, you missed that sort of like end of season sort of, you know, finish.
Buzz. Yeah.
And finish and build up to the year. And you know, unfortunately at Bradford, I went through a few years of that up until I signed at Wigan in 2010, where then it was probably, it was sort of that time where I looked back and thought, right, yeah, this is just another game now, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and trying, you know, it's not, and you know, at the end of it, but the experience and the, you know, that what you've been through as a player teaches you that, you know, you can't win the game in the week or on a Friday or a Saturday, you know. You only win the game as the whistle blows. So don't get too overexcited before that happens.
I'm not rude, mate, but you never, because valuable you were for a spell, you might have a few for granted and just thought you'd be there at a result.
I think that's a fair comment, John. Yeah, I mean, it was at me a five in the trot. I think it was six.
That's what I mean.
You sort of, you just sort of on a roller coaster sort of ride, and you just swept away with it, you know. You training every day, you work hard, you play hard at the weekend, and you do it again, and then you end up in a final, and it's like you don't really know how you get there. You know, you're just playing rugby. Yeah. You know, you're just in every minute and trying your best. Or that's how I felt. And you know, next minute you end up in semis and finals, and just very, very fortunate to play in such a good team. Great player. Yeah.
And not about player yourself, mate. You come away with Daddy Sunderland, the listeners and watchers that might not know, that's man of the match on the big day, isn't it? And how the game's gone, or in the last 5 minutes when you hear that, does it hit you then, or is it when the whistle goes you realise you've had a big part to play in it?
Yeah, certainly not when you hear it when you're playing.
Yeah.
Well, not when I did anyway, because we were losing.
Sorry, mate.
We lost that. It was the famous voluntary tackle. 2002, where I could have had a chance to kick the goal and win the game. But yeah, you know, at the time I'd have given anything to give it back and we'd have won the trophy, you know. But
yeah,
I don't, personal awards like that, yeah, I'm proud I achieved that, but I only achieved that because my team played well around me, you know. So
yeah,
I understand that it wasn't that I could grab the ball and score a 90-metre try and, you know, beat five players. I had to have
Though you could.
I wish. Proud that I'm engraved on the Harry Sunderland, and always be grateful for that. But it's only because the team played well around me, and, you know, unfortunately we lost that day.
Yeah, and you've touched on it a little bit, mate. And so, goal kicking, what about the goal? Did you enjoy it for that? And did you see it as like the one moment you individual challenge, or did you just see it that you've got a good boot, your strike rate's pretty good, and it can influence the result more than the personal?
Well, yeah, I suppose goal kicking started when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Just watching, you know, going to the Wigan games, watching Frano Botica. I used to like go on the field and copy him. And like I said before, I'd be on the field imagining I was kicking a winning goal for the, you know, to win the Challenge Cup, as Wigan won eight times on the trot when I was a child watching him, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could always kick a ball. I had that sort of natural ability just to be able to kick a ball. And something I enjoyed doing. And I suppose in a sort of way, it was, I enjoyed the job.
Yeah.
You know, I enjoyed the, sounds a bit like egotistical or big-headed, but there was part of me that, especially growing up, like I like people saying, oh, you can kick a ball. Have you seen this lad kick?
Yeah.
And that sort of drove me on to be, you know, try and be as good as I could. And then obviously, because I could kick pretty well, I kicked in every team I played in, you know. So I ended up kicking for the England schoolboys. And it's just something I always did. From when I started at 9 years old, you know, and carried it on into my professional career.
Yeah, so there many kicks were, we all kick messy, but sometimes there's some that you're it and you just know it's happening, don't you? Other times you feel like you've probably snatched at it and it goes over. Is there any that have stood out to you as being like, I don't know how I've kicked it, or any that you've hit really sweet but it's missed? Is there any that stand out, or?
Not really, not goal kicks that stand out for that reason. Stood out for good reasons, but there was plenty where I didn't quite connect and they went over. And I was thinking, got lucky there.
Yeah, all the hard work in the week, all deeks in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it is. Yeah. So, but you know, I'm a golfer as well, and the golf ball does strange things at times as well, and it's very, very similar to goal kicking, you know. So
yeah.
I think in a way that playing golf as a kid, and I still do now, it always helped me. with my goal kicking that, you know, you got to shut everything out and just focus on the process, which is hard to do at times. You know, even the professionals can't do it all the time. I certainly didn't do it all the time, and got lucky with a few, definitely.
Yeah. Well, you got to do it, mate, haven't you? So did you come about to finding out you made a team in a century at Bradford, mate? And what did that mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. You know, to be in that team was very humbling. And, you know, I'm still a bit speechless by it now. I still can't believe that I was in it, you know. And
yeah,
you know, the players that played before me. But, you know, maybe because Bradford was so successful in that period that I was there, may have swayed people's opinion and that sort of thing. But yeah, it's an honour to be in that. Amazing, really.
And did he have many like old boy events so you can go and catch up with people? Because I know a few, obviously we'll touch on Sale in a bit, but Mike, isn't he? Jamie's there. So there's a few ex-Bradford lads at Sale with you, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, yeah. But they gets together. We had one, it was a while ago now. We had a dinner over at one of the games where quite a few of us turned up and we had a night out, which was great. But yeah, I keep in touch with a few of the lads who I played with, obviously. I work with two, they're at Sale now, and Jamie Langley and Mike Forshaw. And, I'm still in touch, close touch with Rob Parker, who I played with at Bradford, became a good friend of mine. But yeah, not many others where I'm in regular touch, but you know, any other sportsman, I think, will tell you, John, that once you bump into one, you know, it's like you met him last week. You know, straight back where you left off, really. So that's special. Then relationships you build up that way.
Yeah, the sport's very out on its own for that. Only feels it, doesn't it? It's go anywhere in the world, mate, and bump into someone you've played with, played against, who's followed your career as well, mate. Like, five in here at Wigan the other week, like, you don't get a chance to reflect that much. And like I asked you, and it must be nice to catch up with them. But some of the stuff you've been through, people would understand, would they? And
no, that's right, yeah. You know, sounds a bit cliche, but, you know, people call it a special bond, and I suppose it is. It's a good way of describing it, that it can never be taken away from you, what you went through. And, you know, rugby league's a pretty tough sport as well. So, you know, the training sessions, the games, all that sort of stuff that you've been through, you know, and when you win the trophies as well, you know, that makes it extra special.
The ultimate reward, mate. So what signings really wowed you at that spell at Bradford? You've made really astute signings. I can't remember one, like, I don't like that again, but flop. You know what I mean? Everyone seemed to buy in and do the bit and come out a good signing. Did any realise how well it went? Or
yeah, there was some amazing signings, and there were big names like obviously Henry Paulo I mentioned.
Yeah,
Leslie Vanacolo, Shante Nappi, amazing players. But Bradford had a knack of signing sort of like forwards, you know, tough forwards that, you know, weren't world stars, but came over and some of the best players I've ever played with. You know, Daniel Gartner was one. He signed, I think, from Manly. You know, very unassuming bloke. No bells and whistles about him, but you knew how good a player was when you defended at the side of him, you know. And he was one. Logan Swan was another. David Boyle. Brad Mackay. In 2000, amazing players, you know, in their own right. And like you said, they could spot a player at Bradford, definitely.
Yeah. And what memory really dictates your Bradford spell for you? Is it them winning them trophies, is it?
Sorry, John, I just lost you again with it.
It's all right. Some memories really symbolise your spell at Bradford. Is it the Litz Rose, is it? And them big games.
Memories wise, the finals are brilliant. But one thing I always found out about a final is I can't remember much of the actual rugby of them.
Yeah.
Because of the emotion that's going through you, and it's all a bit of a blur. But also when you win one, you're out celebrating. You know, it's the end of the season, so
yeah.
A copious amount of alcohol being drunk, probably a couple of days after, and you know that can be.
Yeah.
So it's probably they're the biggest memories you get.
Yeah.
The social side of it, you know, when you've accomplished something. You know, the buzz trips back from a Challenge Cup final. You know, you just can't beat them sort of experiences. So, yeah, I think as a player, you know, people ask me, do you miss playing? And I don't really miss playing, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
It's too bloody hard, you know. You get
can't
walk down the stairs 2 days after a game, but you miss that side of it, you know, the camaraderie and, you know, achieving things together, but I'm fortunate that I'm still in that environment, you know, so
yeah,
not on the field and fully appreciating what the lads are going through. But, you know, I feel very blessed to still be in that kind of environment.
Yeah. Well, a little touch on the injuries before we kick with your next move. So you had a few as well, Paul, didn't you? When did your first injury come about? How you fought with it?
It wasn't a major injury, but one of my first injuries I was playing at Oldham for the A team. And back in the day, you sign a contract and it sort of says in the contract you can't play other sports. But I was I used to play football for the college on a Wednesday afternoon, which I love, by the way.
Yeah.
I remember playing in a semi-final of the cup and going down the right wing and getting chopped down and rolling my ankle. My ankle swelled up like a balloon, you know, and we had a game the next night, and I had to sort of say, I just fell over in the playground, you know, just walking.
Yeah.
But I think they knew I did it playing for the college. But
that big picture on the back of the paper didn't help you, did it?
No, that's it. I remember going in thinking, are they going to rip the contract up here or something? Are they going to fire me? But that was sort of my first. I had trouble with my ankles early in my career, but then started strapping them during the games. That was fine. And probably, it's hard to remember what order they happened in. I had that many, but I think one of my first major sort of injuries, I got kicked in the face once in a playoff game at St. Helens away by Apollo Perolini. That was pretty frightening. Like the studs hit me right in the middle of my face and, you know, one just missed my eye and split my sort of cheek right next to your nose all the way down my face. And so that looked horrific, but it wasn't that bad. It was just a bad cut. Probably one of my first serious ones was probably when I detached my retina in a pre-season friendly and I ended up missing a World Club Challenge through it. Ironically, it was Jamie Langley, who I now work with at Sale, who did it. Friendly fire in a tank.
Yeah.
He came from the other side and ended up punching me in the eye. And he went like looking through tracing paper straight away. And I thought, I've done something here. What have I done? So the doctor sort of took me off, said, you'll have to come off. And then I'll never forget it. Went to see the specialist the day after. And she said, yeah, if you don't get operated on in 2 days, you'll lose your sight in your eye. So, that was quite serious.
Yeah.
So, she told me to lay down for 48 hours before she could book me in to operate. And then that was a strange one in itself, that the operation, they sort of like, I've been told they pop the eye out and rest it on your cheek. And then they stitched like a something on the back of my eyeball and then injected it with some gas. And I had to lie on my right side for a week. So I woke up from the operation and it was like I could see a bubble in my eye. In my vision, like looking through a bubble. And it was the gas that was put, I had to lie on my right side so it put pressure on where my retina had detached. So that was a bit strange. I had to lie on my right side for a week and the gas, you know, shrank down and then just disappeared. And yeah, it seemed to work. So that's mad, isn't it? Yeah, crazy. I had some strange injuries. Then I think
you brought your pallet, didn't you?
Not my pallet. No, it got reported in the paper that I did my pallet, but
yeah,
I was playing for Great Britain. I broke my upper jaw, so it was like either side of me my nose, really.
Yeah.
Got a tackle in it. It must have just hit me on the sweet spot, just under my nose. So basically, my top jaw snapped. And I remember being on the floor, and I knew what was going on. I hadn't, like, got concussed or anything, but I just, like, sort of opened my eyes and been on my hands and knees. And it was like somebody had turned a tap on with blood. And it was just going out of me. Straight away, I thought, Jesus Christ, what have I done here? So the doctor come on and saw me, and I ended up walking off the field. He, you know, put the tissues around my nose and trying to stem the bleeding. And I remember walking off thinking, what have I done? Have I broke my jaw? I remember moving my bottom jaw. I went, that feels all right. What have I done? And as I brought my jaw back to my teeth, I felt my top teeth move as I
broke
it down. And I went, oh, Jesus Christ, like. And I started to panic. I thought, I have done
things
here. And it was, from what I believe, it was quite serious at the time, yeah, that they had to stem the blood with, they had to put a catheter up my nose. And Professor Chris Brooks, thankfully, was the doctor for Great Britain. And he was trained. He'd been to America training for car crash injuries. And that's how he described it. It was a bit of a car crash injury. So I had I was lucky that the right person was there to treat me and so very lucky.
Bloody hell, it's heavy. So you touched on international honours there, so we'll go back a little bit. And is you played Lancashire when we had the Ward of the Roses, didn't you?
Yeah.
Is that something you'd like to see come back? And how was that?
Well, it was great. It was a great concept. I thought the first year it was done, I thought, you know, it got really big support by the fans. I think the fans really got behind it.
Yeah.
I remember it dying off. I think it lasted, was it three years? I think
it didn't feel long, did it?
No, it was only about 3 years. And I remember the next year, some players cried off and the fan, you know, the crowd wasn't quite as big. And then the year after it died off again. And I suppose it's like anything like that in rugby league, John. It's the timing of it.
Yeah.
You know, it was sort of squashed into the already tough schedule of the games, you know. So, you know, you're playing that and then you're playing at the weekend, then you're playing in another midweek. And I know they do it over there in the NRL, but it's a great concept. It sounds very good.
Yeah.
But you've got to do it in the right way, you know.
Yeah. Have a place for it, a purpose, weekend or whatever.
A purpose of obviously Lancashire versus Yorkshire, but you know, it could be that you know, we pick the England team from it or something along them lines. But you know, just throwing it in every now and again, it doesn't become anything, does it? It needs to,
no,
like, you know, state of origin, I think, nearly didn't get off the ground in that early days, and then people started to buy in. So,
yeah,
how you get people to buy in, and I think if you do bring it back. Pretty similar to this week, really, that's coming up. It's got to be sort of like on a standalone sort of fixture or...
I feel that, mate, yeah.
I've done some other way, but then the clubs, you know, aren't getting the revenue or the season then becomes too long. And,
yeah.
You know, it's a hard predicament to sort out.
And then when you get called into a Great Britain camp, mate, how does that come about? And what do you remember your first ever moment walking? And was that dancing again for a young shy halfback?
Yeah, very daunting. Yeah, it was 2001. I got called up for it. I think it was the emerging England side.
So, would that be the Knights now?
Yeah, sort of the Knights. Yeah, I think it was 99. I think Great Britain went down under. I think it was 99 or 2000. Yeah, 99 it was. Yeah, 99. I got called up for the emerging England team, and I think Great Britain went down under in 99. That was my sort of first taste of professional international.
Yeah.
That was fantastic experience. And then in 2000, it was the World Cup and I got chosen in the England squad for the World Cup. And again, didn't sort of play the first game and then got a crack. We played Ireland at Edinley and Fiji, which was, you know, amazing experience. You know, like you said, quite daunting. When you're there with all these international world-class players. But amazing experience and, you know, makes me feel, you know, quite honoured. I was very honoured to represent the country, as I was at under-16s in the schoolboys, you know.
Yeah. So, and I'm quite sentimental, mate, so I'd have kept stuff from that. Are you a keeper or a tie-up hunter when you were a kid or out like that?
Well, no, not massively. I've kept all my jerseys. All my jerseys, or all the ones I did end up keeping. It's funny you should ask that. My lad, he's 14 now. He asked to get them down about 2 weeks ago. So I had them all down.
All right.
We tried a few on. We was laughing. Yeah. He actually filled one of my wiggies. Tight ones. So I told him, why don't you wear that to the Challenge Cup final? He said, no, I'm not doing that. I was having it.
You shut off from me.
I was having fun. I wouldn't have let him anyway. But so yeah, in that regard, I have kept my jersey and kept some memorabilia, and you know, obviously I've got my medals. But
yeah,
if I'm honest, most of it's in a bag in the loft.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And
I've got two shirts up in my house. They're actually in the kids' playroom where they play on their Xbox. I got them framed while I was playing because played against Andrew Johns,
one of the
best ever to do it, in my opinion, in 2001. So I remember sprinting over at the final whistle trying to get his shirt off him. Thankfully, we swapped shirts. And then he won the Golden Boot in that year as well. And then the year after, we played against New Zealand, and I ended up swapping my shirt with Stacey Jones at the end of that game, which, again, I think he's probably the second best to ever do it in that position. He was very good as well, so... Yeah, they're the only two shirts I got framed and I've kept.
But anyway, and going and playing against Wigan before we talk about the moves of Wigan, did that have an extra little edge for you? Or
yeah, massively.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I can't shy away from that. There was something in me that I always wanted to, you know, beat them. One for bragging rights with my mates, right?
Yeah.
Home centre back in the day, but... but also, I think there was a little bit in me that wanted to prove that, you know, they missed out on somebody, you know, back in.
Definitely.
Yeah, I can't lie about that. That it did feel like that, yeah.
So how did the move come about, mate? And it's sort of like a fairy tale ending, isn't it? When you can go up and see how you're playing days there, but not only see how heavily contributed. So you were playing as well. It wasn't like it was a talking gesture, for a better term, if you understand what I mean. You went and you actually had an impact there and done a job there. So I'll dip out. And...
Yeah, I think you summed it up pretty well there, John, with the ending it was. It came about out the blue again, you know, as these things normally do. I was on holiday in Egypt with my family. I got a phone call from my agent, said, you know, Wigan are interested in signing you. Would you fancy it?
But you've got to bring a camel home.
But I've got to what, sorry?
Got to bring a camel home with you.
Yeah, it's all right. So that was in the middle of my holiday, and I'm like, well, what do I do here? And I think the thing that swayed it is they offered me a year's playing and then a coaching contract.
Yeah.
And that was the deal. And I think that definitely swayed it for me that, you know, having that sort of security of a job when you do hang your boots up was massive for me. I mean, you know, back then I was, you know, I had a bit of a grumbling knee, and you know, I was getting on a bit, and I was thinking, right, how long can I do this for anymore?
Yeah.
You know, and to be offered that job in my hometown where I still lived, was too good an opportunity to turn down. So, yeah, that's how it came about. I was on holiday and then spent the next 3 nights of the holiday worrying and, you know, mulling it over and thinking I'm doing the right thing. But yeah, I ended up doing the right thing. I think it was the right decision. And, you know, I never, certainly don't regret going back to Wigan.
So with or without the coaching option on the end, is it something you'd go to, do you think? Is it something you'd appeared?
Oh, yeah. I would have definitely thought about it as well. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Just to go back to my hometown club. But, you know, it's like, it is professional sport, so you know, you've got to look at what deals on the table as well. You know, to some fans that might sound wrong, but
it's got to work, Paul. Yeah,
it's got to work. Yeah, and it worked. You know, I did take a pay cut to go to Wigan, but I did that for the right reason to then be on the staff after my career ended. So yeah, that's how I made the decision.
So let's chat about your spell at Wigan, mate. So it was, again, there was trophies involved. It's a semi-new environment for you because you're, like you said, you're a Wigan lad anyway. And then I'm guessing your role's slightly changed as you, which is, you're probably an on-field coach when it anyway, being in the halves. But how do you nurture a bit of game management into young players at Wigan? I'm guessing that was part of your role, Paul.
Yeah, it was, but you know, I tried to do that and I tried to put sort of my help the younger lads coming through with my experience. I started coaching the academy with Matty Pete, who's now the head coach at Wigan.
Yeah.
So me and him took the academy while I was playing there at Wigan. But if I'm truly honest, there was one guy that changed rugby, I think in this country as well at the time, was Michael Maguire, who came up at the same time as I'd signed for the club. And I think all the lads that were there before me would back me up saying he changed everything at Wigan. He changed the culture. You know, and they had a great
team. Do you reckon it needed doing though, Paul?
No, 100% it needed.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like I say, I think the lads that were there before me would back me up and say the same thing, that I got the feeling that, I remember pre-season thinking, Jesus, there's some athletes here. You know, this is a step up from where I come from at Bradford. But they weren't achieving anything. And I think a lot of them players there needed Michael Maguire to come in and change that culture, because he did, and the lads really got to it. You know, that was the feeling I got of an outsider coming in to the Wigan team, that, you know, they wanted that discipline. They wanted, you know, that driving forward, which Michael Maguire and his staff, Mark Bitcon and Wayney at the time, certainly did.
Right. And what about them big moments? How's winning a trophy with your club, which Wigan are your club, aren't they? How are them feelings, man? I think you're at that stage we've gone where it's not another game. You go about your business as it is.
Yeah, you still have them feelings. You know, you never get rid of it, but you know, you learn how to control them. But yeah, I remember, you know, I've not played in a final for 5 years. You know, Bradford had sort of gradually declined and not even getting in the playoffs. So I just felt really lucky to be back there for one.
Yeah.
You know, walking out again at Old Trafford with my hometown club, which was great for my family as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, a proud moment, more for my family, really, that, you know, being a Wiganer. But that was the one game, probably the one and only time where I've walked out for a final knowing we were going to win.
Yeah.
The belief and the feeling amongst the team, we just walked out there thinking, we felt so prepared.
And it felt right, obviously.
Yeah, it felt really, really confident, and thankfully it turned out like that.
So was you in the team when, because he had Harrison Hanson on, and he mentioned something that you might have done, where they just write something down, what it meant to you, and then did Michael have you put it on the halfway line?
Yeah, that was before the semi-final.
Yeah, and was that different for you, something like that?
Yeah, I'd been in a few meetings similar to that.
I
remember doing one in the England World Cup squad back in 2000 with John Keir. You know, where the lads sort of, you sit round and you sort of talk about what it means to you. But yeah, that was a powerful one, that.
Yeah.
I think we missed out. We lost in the semi-final in the Challenge Cup that year. So I think that's why Madge thought we'll do it in this before the semi-final. So I think he thought if we get to the final, we'll be fine, you know. And
sorry, it was at Headingley, wasn't it?
Sorry?
Was it at Headingley, was it? Did you beat Leeds?
We did the meeting, yeah.
Yeah.
Before the Leeds game at Headingley.
Yeah, that's what he said.
And then, yeah, we burned it in the middle of the old changing rooms at the training ground and put it in the urn, and then we took the urn to the semi-final, you know. And
yeah.
You know, a bit of a, you know, something sitting there that reminded us of, you know, what it means to each and every one of us in the squad. And yeah, and then yeah, we won the semi, and then we then took the urn to the final, and yeah, it worked.
Yeah. And did you feel that you were at the tail end, or could you have gone round again, regardless of that coach being there?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I'd only signed 1 year and sat down at the end of that season with Madge.
Yeah.
Madge said, I'd like to go round again if you want to, you know, and undenied, and, you know, was it the right thing for me? And ended up deciding, yeah, you're a long time retired, so
yeah,
I had another crack for another year, which I'm glad I did, because he ended up playing at Wembley.
Yeah.
First time, and winning the Challenge Cup there. So, yeah, that was a good decision as well.
You've done all right, haven't you?
Very, very fortunate, yeah.
But, like, looking back now, with your coaching cap on, the playing's obviously done now, but do you think it was a great symbol of what the local lads could strive to do and be, especially at their own club?
Yeah, I don't... It's hard for me to say, I think.
Yeah.
You'd have to ask them. I do think they were, like I said before, with Madge coming in and sort of with his coaching team and changing the culture of the place, the way the lads sort of bought onto that, I do think maybe they thought, saw me as somebody who'd been there and done it.
Yeah.
Maybe. You know, I'd played in finals and won finals. And
yeah.
Anyone in that squad had done that.
Yeah. But you'd done it away from the club as well, innit?
Yeah, probably Stuart Fielding. Stuart Fielding was in the squad. He'd done that at Bradford as well.
Yeah.
He sort of went earlier, didn't he, a few years before that, and sort of saved them from relegation.
Yeah.
So maybe they saw me as that type of figure, but I think they soon realised I weren't that type of figure. I was just a normal person. Maybe tried to boss them about on the field, that's all. Yeah.
No, because I feel it may be, as much as a buy-in to the likes of Lockers, Faz probably now, a one club man. Maybe it's harder to get everyone expects them types of blows. I know I'm going the long way around it, but if someone's been away from the club and come back to the club, it shows the path what your team can do for you, I think, a bit more, if that makes sense. Because Lockers has always been there, Faz has always been there, like Sam Powell might always be there.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. Does it take a bit of a buy-in to understand that you've not been at the club and you've come back and it's your club, rather than that you've just been part of the furniture? That's difficult because they bring big players in. I'm not underselling what Lockers and Faz and Sam Powell.
No, I sort of get what you're saying. I mean, you know, them three players, you know, Lockers and Faz, I was fortunate to play with them for them 2 years. Mm-hmm. Go on to coach them. They're amazing players, but also amazing blokes. You know, great fellows in their own right. I don't know. I suppose it's like anything, innit? It's like, you know, me going back to Wigan sort of like reinvigorated my career in a way that, you know, I've been at Bradford for 12 years and walking into a different changing room where you don't know anyone, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's exciting and nerve-wracking in the same amount. So, you know, I still got that as a 30-year-old, you know, having been at Bradford and been successful, I was still nervous walking into that change room.
Shows it matters though, doesn't it?
Yeah, but also, would they take to me, you know what?
Yeah.
Because, ironically, apart from Michael Maguire and the coaches team, I was the only signing that season. So, you know, it just goes to show what Madge and Mark Bitcon and Wayne brought to the team, that how they changed them round.
So, coaching, mate, what, without knowing it, do you think you've picked a bit from everybody you've played on and took it into your own style and done what you can with it, without knowing, probably?
Oh, yeah, without doubt. I mean, I did know at the end of my career, because I think it was probably around the end of 2006, I got made captain of Bradford. And I think it was probably then where, you know, Steve McNamara gave me the captaincy, and remember thinking, wow, being captain, you know, of a Super League club, that's a great honour. But I remember thinking to myself, I must be doing something right, you know. People must respect my opinion or whatever. And I think it was at that point where I thought, you know, I could become a coach. And, you know, I am sort of respected in the game. And so from then on, I was sort of like, I always wondered, I wonder why he's doing that, or, you know, why he's playing that, or why are we doing this training session, and what's he trying to get out of the team here? You know, that's how I thought about it.
Yeah.
Probably when I was around 27. So, yeah, definitely took on everything from every coach. You know, and I was blessed going to Wigan knowing that I was going to be a coach at Wigan, working under Michael Maguire, who I said previously, I think changed the game in this country. You know, learning how he did things. Was massive for me going into my coaching career.
And then the sale, mate, how did that come up, and what led you to make a fresh start more?
Yeah, well, you'd not be surprised to know that come out of the blue as well.
Yeah.
I wasn't looking for it at all. I was in a really privileged position at Wigan. I was, you know, second in command under Wayne, assistant coach, and I was assisting Steve McNamara with England as well. So, you know, I was really content, pleased with how my coaching career was going, and then got a phone call from Steve Diamond out of the blue saying, we need an attack coach. Do you fancy it? Which was a shock, massive shock. I was like, I don't know anything about rugby, you know. I'd only played one game at college, actually. So I never played a game, really. But obviously I'd watched it on telly and sort of thought, you know, that you could take a lot from rugby league into that game and, you know, to improve it. And
yeah.
I suppose that was my main reason for going, really. I actually thought I could add something to rugby union from what I'd learned in rugby league.
Yeah.
You know, and massively from I've just said, when Michael Maguire came to Wigan, what, you know, the sort of running lines and the structures that he brought over from Australia, I thought could really, really complement the union game. So,
yeah,
I ended up taking a plunge. That was probably the toughest decision I've ever made. Well, it was the toughest decision, by a long way that I've ever made in my career. As I've said, because I'm in a very privileged position. But, yeah, part of me just thought, why not, you know, try something new, have a go. And again, I suppose the stars aligned in a way that when I came back to Wigan, I couldn't go to anywhere else in rugby union and still live at home, you know, with family still at school. And that was a consideration as well. You know, I could commute over to Manchester. So, there was a few things I had to work out, but like I said, it all seemed to align at the right time. And yeah, again, I don't regret it. You know, I'm really enjoying my time in rugby union.
Yeah. How did you find the transition, mate? As much as you've watched a little bit of it here and had that one game at college, the games are so different, aren't they, Deeks?
Massively different. I mean, walking into that Oldham changing room as a 17-year-old was daunting, but going to rugby union, bloody hell, I was out of my depth. I was like, I was out of my depth, but I wasn't in a way. Like, it may sound funny, but obviously in rugby league, you coach the game, you know sort of everything about the game. Whereas rugby, you know, I was just looking after the attack. You know, that was my job there. So I didn't have to know about lineouts and scrums and the defensive structures and all this, but I had to sort of learn on my feet, really. And, I always remember a guy called Bryn Evans. He was the lineout caller. And for about the first three years I was coaching, he'd come to me every week and say, Deeks, what about this? What about that? And I'd go to him and say, oh, I'm thinking of doing this. No, you can't do that off a five-man lineup because you know this and that. And if we line up as a seven-man, they'll only have these players here. And, you know, all these...
Yeah, your midfield being stacked and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. All the combinations were... So he was a great help in that respect. He was a really smart operator and helped me along the process. But, I just went in there wanting to change the running lines and you know, how we can attract more defenders and preserve the space on the edge. And that's how I started. And then the boys, I think, really bought into that. You know, they'd not been sort of shown that before. And I think that sort of got me foot in the door with the players, where they thought, yeah, this is good, this can work. And then the rest I just learned as I went along.
Yeah, but you've not had, mate, have you? So could you think Union could benefit from the little, like, World Cup challenge? So is that something you think Union would buy into if they get a Southern Hemisphere side interested?
Yeah, maybe. I don't see why not. I mean, it would probably... In Union, you'd think they'd probably do it against the European champions.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, because there's that many leagues throughout the world. It's a little bit different. So,
yeah.
You know, like the top 14 is, that's Wales, Ireland, Scotland and South Africa now are in that tournament. So,
yeah.
I believe the South African teams are being invited into the European Cup next season.
Yeah, I've made, yeah.
Yeah, so... yeah, I think they could do it. It's just how it would fit into the calendar. I think they are trying to make it a world sort of calendar, but I don't think it's getting there yet. And it's where you fit it in, you know, because obviously they've got their international windows throughout the season.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that would work, but yeah, I think it would be a great concept.
And how do you find the difference between Premiership rugby and European Cup rugby? Do you find it a different mix and battle, do you?
Yeah, a little bit, slightly, yeah. You know, the French teams are enormous. They've got the biggest men I've ever seen in my life while playing in that French team. You know, they're a little bit more set piece bias, you know, they're forwards from the scrummaging and the mauling and the line out. And the backs are, they do play off the cuff a little bit more, I think, in France. I think the top 14 league were, you get the Irish teams and the Welsh and the Scots, and they play a bit more. You know, they let the ball in hand because there's no relegation in their league, I think helps that. So that's the fascinating thing I've found about rugby union, that every game's different, whether it's in the Premiership or, you know, you watch a Six Nations game or you watch Super Rugby.
Or even the Prem Cup, maybe, when you've got a few fringe players in and that.
100%, yeah. They want to prove themselves. You know, even in the same league, you can win games differently by doing different things, and different teams use different tactics. So I think that's, you know, that's the thing that's really, really interesting in the rugby union game, that I find, that one game you can have a really open game where the ball's in play for a long time, and then, you know, you play the next week and
it's a discipline battle, isn't it?
Exactly. The team can kick the ball if they want more, and it's a more tight game, and it's one in the set piece. So, that can be frustrating at times, especially for an attack coach. But you learn to live with that, and you know that game, that them the laws of the game. That's what they play to, and you know, each team tries to find the best way of beating that team on that given game.
Yeah, and I think, especially this year, mate, which you'll know yourself because you've seen obviously every team, but I think we've had a lot more rugby in the Prem because of, I'm not saying it's going to be a dumb thing and that, but because we have sort of ring fenced it this year, haven't we?
There's no relegation this year.
No, that's it. And then obviously the ground to the two teams that could have come up weren't deemed good enough, but that's a different thing. But do you think that, mate, the fact that you don't have to worry about going down, so you can play a bit more and
Maybe. I don't, if I'm truly honest, I don't think it will make that much difference, because you want to win a game, whether you're going or whether you're not. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I do believe that, I don't think it'll change that much, because, you know, it's not like, oh, yeah, we can throw the ball away today. We might lose. We're not going down. You don't, not having any team think that way, you know. You want to win a game. So,
yeah.
So I just think it's the game's ever evolving. You know, and some games, the Super Rugby's, the ball's, you know, flung out a lot more, but, you know, they're playing the sunshine and dry fields, and you know, that's very, very hard to do in the depths of January and December, isn't it? So
it is, mate.
Winds and the wind coming down. So you got to play the conditions as well. So, yeah, we'll just see how it goes. But, you know, I think I would like to see the game evolve in the fact that, you know, there are a lot of stoppages. You know, that's probably one thing that really frustrates me. Like, you know, like a scrum. If there's a scrum, you know, a prop forward can drop to his knee and then the medic comes on and...
Yeah, or there's a reset and all that, yeah.
Stop the game because he's a prop, you know, he can't do the scrum. Yeah. I think that has got to be looked at, that, you know, because there are little tactics there where teams can time waste and, you know, upset the rhythm of the opposition.
Yeah.
You got to be able to cope with that, but I'm not sure how they can do it, but I do think that needs looking at.
And all they're stopping the water carriers being cold. And all they're on the water carriers, if, say, it's a set piece, then the water carrier will be the scrum coach, for instance.
Yeah.
Or if there's a break, yeah, it's a rain, so they're not stopping that. Agree or make it only one. I think you're right. And the video ref has a lot in it, don't they? So you could be six phases on an incident and he'll still tell him, or something's happened, getting it up. I'm not saying right or wrong. I quite like the fact that it's the use it sort of thing. But do you think it might have a bit too much of a say?
I'm not sure about the TMO. I think the process of coming to the decision can be quicker. I think they can really slicken that up, you know, because they do go back and forward and have a chat to each other and, you know, they want it right. I understand that and everybody wants it right. But I do think there's certain calls where it's like, yeah, that's a penalty, you know, and that's the end of it, get on with it type thing.
Yeah.
But I think I do think that sort of TMO in rugby union, they do it really well. I think they do it the best.
I think so, yeah.
That I've seen, probably American football do it really well, but that is a stop-start game, so it's a lot easier to do it in that game. You know, like you said there, where they can go back six phases, at least the game's been carrying on.
Yeah.
You know? So I quite like the way they do it. I think they do it really well. I just think it can be sped up.
Yeah, I do think it works personally. I think that's one of the things we stand out on really in rugby union, is that that's right.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, look at VAR in football, you know.
Oh, I don't know, mate, yeah.
That's another conversation altogether.
Right, mate, so it's that time of the chat where I ask you a few daft questions. So any pre-match superstitions?
No superstitions, no, but I had a routine. Of things in order. And I like to get a rub, so I had to get my ankles strapped before I had the rub, otherwise the tape wouldn't stick to my legs and sort of things. And so yeah. I had a routine only to get through the time, because you used to be in the changing rooms for about an hour before you went out for warm-up. So, yeah, the routine, right. All superstition.
Yeah. So the toughest player you've played with against, mate?
That is a very tough one. There's been loads. You know, back in the early...
The definition's different for everyone, isn't it?
Of course, yeah, but stereotypical tough play, I'd say. Early days, Bernard Dwyer.
Yeah.
Probably middle period, Adrian Morley. Remember him coming over, playing for Bradford at the end of one season when he came back from the Roosters, and he was immense. And probably the end of my career, I played with probably Mickey McLaurin at Wigan.
Yeah.
He's definitely one of the most, he's up there, most mentally tough.
Popular choice, Mickey Mack.
Tough.
So your favourite away ground, Deeks?
Ooh, in rugby league, I used to love playing at Headingley in the derbies.
That's a popular one, I think.
But I think as a stadium, I'd probably say Hull, the new Hull Stadium.
Yeah,
that was really nice with the filled in corners. But I'd say for atmosphere back in the day, you know, probably Headingley.
Yeah. Right, mate. So if you've had a few and it's end of season, you're celebrating, the mic's ended up in your hand, mate, what you're giving us?
it'd be very badly, but I'm not very good on karaoke. I don't do it very often, but when I have done it, I've done You Can Call Me Al by Paul Simon.
You've been listening to Trot the Egging. Thanks to our sponsors, Bardell Sports. Follow us on Twitter @TrotTheEgging and Instagram @Trot_the_egg_in.